Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Tanzania is an East African nation with a population of 40 to 50 million people and just 3 neurosurgeons. You don't have to be a math wizard to know that there are a lot of brain tumors and head injuries that lead to great suffering and death because Tanzanians can't get needed medical care. Enter American doctor Dilan Elagala. Born in Sri Lanka, he moved to the U.S. with his family at age 6, fulfilling his lifelong dream of becoming a physician. At the end of an exhausting residency and fellowship training period, where he averaged nearly 2 neurosurgeries a day, Elagala decides to find himself in Tanzania, going there to essentially hang out while his medical student girlfriend goes on a rotation there to work hard saving babies and children. Elagala can't stay restful for long. With a strong sense of justice, he finds it unacceptable that Tanzanians take a backseat to the foreign doctors from Europe and the United States. Not afraid to ruffle feathers, Dr. Elagala comes up with some innovative solutions for a health professional shortage region and nation that have increasingly gained international attention. This story is beautifully told in the newly released book, A Surgeon in the Village, An American Doctor Teaches Brain Surgery in Africa. It's written by my guest today, author Tony Bartlemy, who is a senior projects reporter with the Charleston, South Carolina Post and Courier. Tony Bartlemy is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Tony Bartlemy, welcome to the program. The name of the book is A Surgeon in the Village, An American Doctor Teaches Brain Surgery in Africa. Tell us the story, I guess, if you will, of Dilan Elagala, this American-trained neurosurgeon, sort of where he comes from and, I guess, his background. And then we'll get into kind of what he's done and the content of your book.
Dilan Elagala is a neurosurgeon based in Virginia right now. I met him in Charleston. He's originally from Sri Lanka, came over to the United States when he was a child. Always wanted to be a doctor, then really embarked on the arduous journey that every neurosurgeon takes to become a neurosurgeon, which really leaves brain surgeons fully trained not until they're really in the early mid-30s.
You write in sort of the midsection of the book about Dilan Elagala's training, and one of the reasons that he goes to Africa, Tanzania, for the first time is because he's finally finished this arduous number of years of his training. And frankly, he's pretty burnt out. He's pretty disillusioned on the whole thing. And he winds up going to Tanzania with his girlfriend. But I guess before we get to that, tell us, what were some of the extremes he was pushed to in residency?
Yeah, John, many people, I certainly didn't realize how much work it requires to become a neurosurgeon, that he would work 120 hours a week, day and night, night after night, doing one procedure after another. One year, he did something like more than 650 neurosurgeries. And all this work, and then all this pressure to do it right and correctly, and then all the death that you experience, it just leaves you, according to him, just emotionally in tatters by the end of that long tunnel that they go through.
And you don't really cover hazing so much, but you do talk a little bit about the male machismo culture and surgery, particularly in his case, neurosurgery, but it's not a very kind place to women, and you sort of give the example of a lawsuit that actually took place. That was news to me, where I guess one of the female trainees actually wound up suing and winning quite a bit of damages for some terrible treatment she had suffered.
Yeah, and surgery for a long time has really been very much a male-dominated specialty, kind of a macho, almost a military-like atmosphere, and he was at several programs where women were pretty rare to begin with. That's changed a lot, but he some women were treated not very well and filed harassment lawsuits.
So Dilan finishes, I guess, his long neurosurgery residency. He winds up doing an extra fellowship, I think it was in spine at Harvard.
So he goes through med school, and then you embark on a residency. And for him, that was 7 years, mostly at the University of Virginia. And then you take an additional year of fellowship, and he did it at Harvard, to do cerebral vascular medicine, which is one of the most difficult forms of neurosurgery. That's where you operate on aneurysms, those tiny blood vessels that weaken in your brain. And when they explode, you have a stroke. And that's he became a specialist in disarming those tiny little time bombs.
One of the things that was interesting about Dilan's story is that it seems like, and maybe this was just the lens of your craft and the focus, but he was given a lot of responsibility early on, both in residency. I think I recall reading that in the very first weeks of his residency, he seemed to have a lot of responsibility in some of the initial surgeries because he was working with the surgical chief. And then again, in fellowship, he was doing these operations where they'd have to literally stop the heartbeat of the patient and cool them way down. And he, you know, he was involved in this in a very, but by that time he'd had a lot of surgical training, but it seemed like he did have a lot of responsibility early. And I suppose that was very formative in what he came to do.
Yeah, I think a lot of, it certainly opened my eyes that residents with very little experience are doing some pretty complicated surgeries. And that's how surgeons are trained in the United States. You see one, do one, teach one. Is kind of the mantra of the kind of surgical training in the United States. And that hands-on training means that young people are put in very, very responsible positions early in their careers.
Yeah, so that is really kind of one of the frames of reference you use to structure the book, the see one, do one, teach one. And that's, I mean, I would hasten to say it's not just in surgery, although that's probably where it makes the most sense, but even in my field, internal medicine, we do that with various procedures, not as complicated, but things like putting in central lines. And I would say in some ways that's been debunked because, I mean, I can't speak for surgeons, but we now have all kinds of very high fidelity simulators we can use and things that make it. So we actually do many and we get better. I mean, if you look at some of the literature around repetition, but you write very well about, you know, neural pathways. I mean, that's the nice way you explain how the philosophy of surgery, how by doing these things under great duress, you know, sleeplessness and, you know, hunger and pain, how these surgeons are really able to deal with these very stressful situations that are often emergencies, especially in neurosurgery where people are bleeding in the brain or where they say time is brain.
Yeah, it's probably true in a lot of professions that require sort of deep intuitive skills, you know, like even like shooting a basketball. You know, you work at it, you work on your practice, you build those neural pathways, and you know, architecture in your brain changes, so you're able to get even better and better. So, yeah, there's really no substitute for repetition.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest is Tony Bartlemy. He's a senior projects reporter with the Charleston Post and Courier and author of The Surgeon in the Village. It's the story of Dilan Elagala, who was born in Sri Lanka, came to the U.S. at age 6, and was raised here and became a neurosurgeon. And Tony, he winds up getting quite burnt out at the end of his incredibly long and arduous training. And he winds up going with his girlfriend at the time, Jenny, to Tanzania, Africa. She's going there because she is a medical student, so she's a little bit further back in the pipeline than he is. He really is kind of going for some R&R, but he kind of gets pressed into duty. So share that with us.
The one thing I loved about this story was, you know, Dilan goes to Tanzania not to save the world. He goes there really to save himself. He's burnt out, and he decides, well, I'm going to go with my girlfriend for 6 months and relax, which I thought was kind of funny in itself. You know, that's your idea of relaxation. And so he,
yeah.
That's what he wanted to do, and he really wanted to sort of live in a place and not be a tourist. But you know, he was staying really in a hospital with his girlfriend, who was doing a program there. And then he realizes that he is that people with head injuries there really simply just die because there are no brain surgeons there to help them.
And I think the numbers are something like there's 3 brain surgeons in the whole country of Tanzania, which is how many millions of people is it?
Yeah, so it's between 40 and 45 million people, depending on the year. And it's there were 3 brain surgeons for the entire country.
And Dilan is not in like Dar es Salaam, you know, the capital and largest city. I mean, where he's out way out there in a place called Haitham.
Yeah, in a village called Haitham that was on the edge of the Great Rift Valley, hours from the nearest paved road. Sort of as the crow flies, a couple of hours from the Serengeti, about a 2-hour drive.
Now, you wound up doing, you went there to do reporting, did you not?
Yeah, originally I was in the newsroom one day about 6 years ago, and my boss comes over to me and says, hey, there's this crazy brain surgeon at the university. He's opening up people's heads with a tree saw. Go find out what he's doing. And so I met him for lunch, and I was immediately struck by his charisma and his story. And so he said, Tony, you know, the only way to really understand the severity of this overall problem of the global shortage of surgeons and what I'm doing and how I'm trying to solve it is by coming with me and experiencing it for yourself.
Give us a little bit of a picture of what Hiteum is like. I mean, you pointed out it's dirt roads, hours from the nearest urban outpost. And again, there's a little bit of a missionary flavor there as well from Norway originally, right?
Yeah, it was built. There was nothing there 60 years ago until a group of missionaries from Norway arrived and just built a hospital. And then over time, several thousand people gathered around the hospital. And now it's actually one of the largest hospitals in the region, serving more than 1 million people. And so the hospital is the heart, the beating heart of this town. There is, it's all dirt roads. There's a little bit of electricity. Everybody has cell phones, very few vehicles. Ambulances are perhaps the most notable vehicle you'll see on the roads. But it's a wonderful place.
So Dilan Elegala is there. He's a freshly minted neurosurgeon, very burnt out. He goes to rural Tanzania really for rest and relaxation, and he really pushes back. I mean, it seems like they're quite used to having foreigners, that is, you know, Westerners from Norway or Europe or the United States, come to do rotations and to spend some time doing medical work there. And so they sort of expect him to do it, but he says, listen, I'm just here with my girlfriend. I'm here to have fun. So how does he eventually get bitten into helping out?
Well, he has a real strong sense of justice. And when he goes there, he notices something in the meetings. Every morning the doctors gather and have a morning meeting. That's true there. And it's true here in the United States as well often. And he notices that the foreign doctors are running the meetings. They're standing in the front or sitting in the front, and the Tanzanians are kind of pushed to the back. And that really, really bothers him. So one of the first things he does when he gets there, he says, everybody switch chairs. Foreign doctors in the back, Tanzanians in the front. That was a symbolic move to kind of equalize the scales, I guess.
How is that received when he does that?
Well, he's a very charismatic guy, so people tend to just kind of follow him, so, which is I noticed many times. But I think there was relief. I think the foreign doctors, he remembers the foreign doctors seemed a little relieved in how they kind of knew what to do in this foreign country. So they moved back, and there was no bitterness about that. The Tanzanians weren't sure at all what to make of it, though. And they were a little uncomfortable at first.
And you have a section in the book about how in many lesser developed countries in Africa, there are at least regions or parts of these places, I guess in the medical realms, where they've become quite dependent on foreign aid or foreign workers who come for short periods of time to do a lot of things, but who don't really stay, so there's not a lot of continuity.
No, that's a big problem. There's more than 6,000 medical missions organized every year from the United States to places like Hiteum, and by and large, most of those missions involve doctors and nurses who stay for a week or two and then go on vacation and try to treat as many patients as they can and then leave. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a noble thing to want to help others, but there are unintended consequences of this model. And one of them is they're more dangerous because of the lack of continuity and follow-up care. And they also teach dependence. You know, they send a message that you can't take care of your own people, and that has a ripple effect throughout their system.
So Dilan Elegala starts to chafe a little bit at the culture where the foreigners get the seats around the table and the native Tanzanians are pushed to the back. And so he first tries to switch that around and make it more proper in the sense that let the folks for whose country it is be central to the role, to do the learning and to be present and help make decisions. What else happens? I mean, he starts to see some trauma cases, and he sort of gets pulled in.
Yeah, one of his first patients, you know, he is a guy as a farmer who comes in with a, has been beaten in the head, and he's about to die. He's losing consciousness, and Dilan realizes that he doesn't have a simple saw to open up this man's head. He could save this man in 15 minutes of surgery. If he had a saw, but he has no saw, so he realizes that there's nothing he can do. So he decides to go for a run, and he's jogging down the airstrip of an hour later when he sees a man off in the distance using a tree saw to cut off some tree limbs. And he thinks, well, maybe that'll work. So he buys a saw off this somewhat startled farmer and goes back to the hospital, sterilizes it, and uses it to open this farmer's head and save his life. And then afterward, he thinks, you know, now I have all these patients. Before I couldn't do anything. Now I have all these patients. What happens when I leave? And that becomes a turning point.
Right. And so he sort of makes notice of this one guy named Emmanuel Maiga, who becomes a central character in the story. And Maiga is someone who's called, I believe, is it an assistant medical officer? He's not an MD or a trained physician, right? He sort of has some medical training, but it's like the equivalent of basically high school. Is that right?
Yeah, he's not a doctor. In East Africa, clinical officers or clinicians are people with high school educations and then a couple of years of clinical training, you know, doing very sort of basic work to treat people's minor injuries. And Maiga had done some advanced clinical training, which means he could actually he could deliver babies, for instance. But he certainly was not anything close to being a doctor.
Right. And so, again, he's already upset the apple cart in a way by changing some cultural paradigm there where the foreigners had been central to the table. So he identifies this clinical officer who, again, is not a doctor. But, of course, where they are in Haydom, there really aren't any doctors to speak of except the foreigners, unless I have that wrong. But he sees something in Maiga and says, I'm going to teach you how to do brain surgery.
Yeah, you're exactly right. There were no Tanzanian MDs there at that point. But he sees something in Maiga that he sees all the characteristics of a surgeon, of the surgeons he knows over the years, and you know, kind of a swagger, a confidence, and an intelligence, and so he begins. He decides, well, maybe I can expand Maiga's idea of what he can do, and maybe do brain surgery.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest is Tony Bartlemy. He is the senior project reporter with the Charleston Post and Courier and author of the new book, A Surgeon in the Village, An American Doctor Teaches Brain Surgery in Africa, just out from Beacon Press. And Tony, so Delon Elagala finds Emmanuel Maiga. He starts to train him. He brings him into the operating room. And, you could basically say that Emmanuel Maiga is a sort of a first assist, and he just literally learns at the hands an apprenticeship, but a very accelerated one. In about 3 months, he's done most of what I guess Delon thinks that can be done there. And that's like some of these evacuations for hematomas or putting in these what are called ventricular peritoneal shunts, these little tubes that help drain extra fluid in the brain away down into the abdomen. And there comes a point where he sort of moves back and lets Maiga kind of lead the way. And then he goes further into the third outer circle until there comes a point where he says, you know what? You're on your own. I'm not coming in tomorrow or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And one thing Delon does after teaching Maiga that's really key and different, and that's he teaches Maiga how to teach. And he just plants that seed. Because Maiga is beginning to do lots of surgeries on his own. Delon sees that. But, you know, if Maiga can teach somebody else, then you have the ripple effect.
So he's done this, and, one thing that struck me a little bit was you portray Maiga as a pretty competent and assertive guy, but when Delon Elagala makes that declaration, okay, Emmanuel Maiga, you're going to be on your own tomorrow. The next scene in the book is Maiga kind of shows up drunk, which was kind of a surprise, but I guess maybe that was how he was sort of girding his mettle to get ready, because I guess he showed up the next day and did fine.
Yeah, Maiga was that night. He was he was dealing with his stress in a way that's, you know, you don't really want to see. And he was nervous. He was nervous, but you know, he put it together the next day and did fine from then on.
So Delon Elagala, the neurosurgeon, he winds up breaking up with his girlfriend, who essentially brought him there. She winds up I think, going back to med school in the U.S. He stays for a little while, but eventually, I guess, his time there is running out, and he takes a job. I think it's in Oregon.
Yeah, he takes a job in Oregon, and but he misses the place. You know, it's sort of deep in his bones now, and he really wants to get back. And then he does everything he can to get back, include really risking his career with his boss. In the end, you know, he basically fires his own boss and says, "I'm going back to Tanzania." And he goes back to Heidemann, and there he finds his real love of his life.
And so twofold, I guess, right? Because he finds his marriage partner. Tell us about her.
Well, she is. The reason I sort of loved their love story and really made it an important part of the book was that it sort of symbolizes this contrast between the missionary doctor, embodied by his future wife, Karen, and then his, Dahlan, sort of teaching first focus. And so Karen is a Dutch pediatrician there who goes there for an extended period. She decides to be a missionary doctor. She wants to save as many children as possible. And she goes there, and she quickly realizes, well, she doesn't quickly realize, she realizes that in the end that she has been kind of burning herself out in her desire to save every baby. There's never enough that she can do to really do her job properly. So she meets Dahlan. At first she doesn't really care for him, but in the end, things change.
Yeah, it took me maybe a little while, and I suddenly realized, like, oh, I see where this is going. But it's still a nice love story, as you point out. And, you know, as you point out, she is this missionary doc, and even when they go away on their honeymoon, it just shows how thin Heidemann and the medical establishment is that, like, the mortality rate for the pediatric unit kind of goes way up just when she's gone. I mean, so they're so dependent on her, and there is this contrast between he had teaching as the forefront of what he was hoping to do, was teach others so that when he left that those others would go on and continue the chain of teaching. And meanwhile, she was just seeing as many patients as she could, a noble pursuit to be sure, but not really creating independent people who could follow in her wake.
Exactly. And then she even does a little bit of teaching, but that's not enough. It has to be a really comprehensive teaching program. And she leaves on their honeymoon, and she comes back, and there are all these children who've died. And she, till this day, she's incredibly moved by that that absence, and that guilt that comes with it.
Well, there was one other, there were many other challenges, to say the least, but one of the things that happens, Dahlan has this epiphany moment where he basically, as you said, fires his boss in Oregon, decides he's going to go back to Tanzania because he's literally homesick for this place where he'd only been for a few weeks to months the first time, but this is where he wants to sort of make his life and his other great love is this project to... He finds out from some students that have agreed to kind of go with him, and they gather some data on some of Emmanuel Maiga's patients. And at first blush, these numbers look terrible. I mean, the morbidity or mortality rates are actually very high, and he thinks, oh my gosh, what have I done? Like, I've unleashed this non-physician, non-surgeon doing surgeries, and the outcomes are bad. But then when he looks more carefully at the data, he starts to realize something else.
Yeah, it was his worst nightmare. He really wanted to measure whether his teaching had worked. Were the patients doing okay? And then he sends a couple of researchers out there, and they at first glance find that these patients had not done well overall. But then he digs into the data, and he realizes that a lot of these patients died because they had malaria or pneumonia, which had nothing to do with the with the surgery itself, and more to do with follow-up care and some of the problems of care in the hospital after the surgeries.
And there's also a problem, it turns out, with some of the equipment that they sort of jury-rig together, like for the shunts. And so once they kind of correct that problem, things start to go a lot better.
Yeah, so he shunts are basically tubes that kind of go from the brain into the abdomen and drain the brain. So you have to see these babies with big heads, hydrocephalus, and it's a death sentence without these shunts, and in most cases. And So he didn't have any shunts, any proper shunts for a while, and so he used IV tubes. And they seemed to work when he was there. And in some cases they did, but in other cases they didn't, and they really weren't a proper solution. So he realized he'd made a mistake.
So as you point out there, it turns out that a lot of these deaths that occur in the patients that Maiga has treated are really more due to the sort of difficult health conditions in rural Tanzania, like you say, malaria or other types of infections that aren't really related to the surgery itself. But in one scene where they're doing a brain operation, there's a fly in the operating room. What happened there?
I saw that myself. I witnessed a lot of these operations, and they have a nurse who stands there with a fly swatter.
I just cringed when I read that part. So in the end, then, how successful is Dilan Eligala at perpetuating the forward motion of the train-the-trainer model?
Well, I think that that can best be answered by looking at what happened. You know, Maiga taught a second Tanzanian who taught a third. That second Tanzanian is now running that hospital. That hospital built and run by Norwegians for all these years. The third one ran for parliament. These are just three, but of many examples of medical leaders that have been created.
One last thing I wanted to ask you about, and you address this in the book too, is you talk about how in the United States, due to perhaps poor planning or foresight, there was at one point, at least, I guess, in the 1970s, we thought that there were going to be too many physicians. So we sort of clamped down on the pipeline at that point, and we wound up getting international medical graduates taking sort of the best and brightest from Pakistan, India, Africa, and that we created this huge brain drain. So one of the reasons that these lesser developed countries have so few doctors is because many of them now traditionally want to come and train in the U.S. or even stay here.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of biggest public health stories hiding in plain sight is that the shortage of doctors and surgeons in the United States were desperately short, and especially in many rural areas, Oklahoma, across the country, really. And and one way we've been solving this shortage is by recruiting doctors from overseas. And today, one out of four doctors in the United States were trained overseas. And while we need doctors here, in many low-income countries need them much, much more.
Well, it's a very inspiring story, the story of neurosurgeon Dilan Eligala and how he sort of finds himself in Tanzania, in rural Tanzania. The name of the book is A Surgeon in the Village, An American Doctor Teaches Brain Surgery in Africa, by my guest today, Tony Bartlemay, who is Senior Projects Reporter at the Charleston Post and Courier in South Carolina. And it's just out from Beacon Press. Tony Bartlemay, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, John.
Well, that's Studio Tulsa for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.